From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. South African journalist Charlene Smith was raped a year ago. The article she wrote about the attack helped inspire a movement to reform how South Africa's legal and healthcare systems treat rape victims. According to Interpol, South Africa has the highest incidence of rape in the world. Rape victims worry about getting AIDS. South Africa has the world's fastest growing rate of HIV infection. We'll talk with Charlene Smith about the rape and the reform she is seeking. Later, we'll talk about current HIV controversies in South Africa with Philip van Niekerk, editor of the South African weekly The Daily Mail and Guardian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal officials say they'll investigate why a controlled burn in New Mexico flared out of control near Los Alamos today. The fire raged through the town of Los Alamos, burning as many as 400 houses. The flames forced the town's 11,000 residents to evacuate, followed by about 7,000 more from the suburb of White Rock. Officials in the Bandelier National Monument set the fire to reduce the fire hazard from heavy brush, but winds blew the fire out of control last week. At the White House today, President Clinton announced a new program to help women get access to jobs and job training because, he says, the wage gap is still too great, especially in high-technology businesses. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton celebrated Equal Pay Day today by marking the fact that women have to work on average more than 16 months to earn what an average man earns in 12. He said the wage gap is still too big in the high-technology industry, where some of the highest-paying jobs occur.
After accounting for education and age and occupation, the pay gap in information technology jobs is, unfortunately, about the same as it is in other occupations.
The president cited a report from his Council of Economic Advisers on information technology jobs. The jobs pay 80% above the national average, but fewer than one in three high-tech jobs are filled by women. Industry representatives say the reason is not discrimination, but that too few women prepare themselves for these jobs by studying math, science, or computers in college. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
The cost to Los Angeles County of the Rampart police corruption investigation has more than doubled in the past month, and there's no end in sight. NPR's Aaron Schachter reports from Los Angeles.
Officials believe the cost is now $11.4 million, and they say more than a quarter of new funds are slated for the ongoing probe. That represents a fraction of L.A. County's $15 billion budget, but the county supervisor says it's money that won't go towards vital services like public hospitals and child abuse investigations. The inquiry is costing other agencies. The district attorney, the public defender, and alternate public defender's offices are each shelling out millions of dollars and expect their total to double as well as more officers in other police divisions come under suspicion. So far, about 30 Rampart officers have been relieved of duty, accused of beating, framing, and even shooting innocent people. 73 felony convictions have been overturned. Aaron Schachter, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 178 points, or 1.8%, to close at 10,545. Advances led declines by 2-1 in heavy trading of 955 million shares. The Nasdaq gained 115 points to close at 3,499. This is NPR. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said today that he hasn't decided yet whether he'll keep up his campaign for Senate, but he rejected rumors that he was planning to quit. Giuliani announced yesterday that he and his wife are separating. He's also trying to determine what kind of treatment he'll take for his recently announced prostate cancer. India said today that it has reached the 1 billion population mark. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from New Delhi.
42,000 babies are born each day in India, adding nearly 16 million people a year. The baby officially designated as the 1 billionth Indian, a girl, was born this afternoon at New Delhi's Safdarjung Hospital. She's been named Asta, Hindi for faith. Her father works in a car parts store and earns 2,200 rupees, about $50 a month. Though India was among the first countries to introduce a national population program in 1952, the country's population has almost tripled in the 50 years since independence. The increased population has strained India's ability to provide enough food and clean water. If India's population continues to grow at its current level, it will surpass China as the world's most populous country by mid-century. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
In Maine today, the state Senate approved a bill that would allow the state to buy prescription drugs in bulk as a way to lower prices for consumers. The measure was an alternative to a controversial bill that would have created a state board to limit the prices for prescription drugs. Under the new bill, the state would seek substantial discounts from drug companies and pass the savings on to consumers who don't have prescription drug insurance coverage. Governor Angus King said it could serve as a model for the rest of the nation. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 1 year ago, South African journalist Charlene Smith wrote an article which began like this. Every 26 seconds in South Africa, a woman gets raped. It was my turn last Thursday night. Before I began writing this, I took AZT, 3TC, and Crixivan. They are antiretroviral drugs. They will hopefully help lessen the potential of my getting AIDS from the rapist, assuming, of course, that he is HIV positive. In a country where 1,800 people contract HIV every day, it's a gamble I refuse to take. Smith's article in the South African paper The Mail and Guardian made quite an impact. It helped inspire a movement that she is quite active in to reform how the country's legal and healthcare systems treat rape victims. I asked Charlene Smith how aware she was of her risks of being raped and what precautions she took before she was attacked.
I had a friend that I went to school with who was always frightened that she'd be raped at some stage in her life. But foolishly, I thought that I didn't fit the profile of what a woman raped would be like. I'm not entirely certain what I thought that profile was. I thought that I was successful, very independent, very together. I thought, you know, people like me don't get raped. And then on the 1st of April last year, I found that that was simply untrue.
Tell us your story. What happened to you? A man broke into your house. What happened?
I'd gone out to a business meeting and returned home at 8:30 in the evening. I'd been out for 2 hours. Beforehand, 10 days before that, I'd received a phone call from a man who said that his name was Aaron and told me he loved me. I put the phone down. When I got back from lunch later that afternoon, there was a message from him saying that if you will not speak to me, I will F you. I phoned the police. They said there was nothing they could do about such messages. However, I was sufficiently concerned that I put a copy of the tape from my answering machine in a box and I noted it down in my diary and told my son about it. When I returned home that evening, I did the typical South African thing, looking out for hijackers, checking the gate. The dogs, I've got three dogs, they weren't reacting at all. And I always thought that they would tell me in some way if someone was in the house, but they were just sitting on the patio. I walked into the house, I locked the door and locked myself into the house with a rapist. I noticed that there were more lights on than when I'd left, but thought that my son, who'd gone to movies with friends, had possibly come back. I went into my bathroom, and as I turned round and was flushing the toilet, he appeared in the doorway with a knife. And a million things flashed through your head, and I thought, my gosh, he's come to rob the house. And I started screaming. I thought that was the thing to do. And he said, if you scream, I will kill you, and grabbed me, pulled me out of the room, demanded money. I didn't have any money with me. He then moved me to the middle of the room, said, is anyone coming home? And I realized that if I said someone was coming home soon, he would realize quickly that I was lying and that I had to play for time. So I said someone would be coming home in an hour or two. And he said, is it your husband? And I said, yes, although I'm not married. He then said, where is your son? And that worried me because I realized that he knew that I had a son. And I said, no, he's not coming home tonight, which was also untrue. I said, he's sleeping out at friends. And that helped focus me because I realized my son was coming home at 11. That this thing had to be over, regardless of what happened, before my child came home. He then said he was going to tie me up and went to my bedroom cupboard, and I thought, well, he's going to use stockings or scarves or something. But he took thick masking tape out of the cupboard, which I usually kept in a cupboard in the kitchen. And I then realized that he'd planned this, that he'd been waiting for me. I still didn't think that I'd be raped. He tied my hands behind my back, and he then said, and now we're going to have sex. And I was interested that he didn't use foul language. I'd always assumed that people who rape you would use foul language, but he didn't. I then said to him, I remember reading a story about two women who were attacked, and the one woman said that she had AIDS, and they left her alone and they raped her friend. So I said to him, I have AIDS. And he said, well, then I'll use a condom.
Did your rapist use a condom?
No, no. He then undid my clothing, pushed me onto the bed, undid his clothing, and began raping me. And that was when I learnt the first of one of many interesting lessons from being raped. The laws all over the world talk about rape as though it's an assault using the penis as a weapon. However, what I realized with the person who raped me and what I've subsequently realized with many, many women and children that I now deal with is that he was sexually dysfunctional. He had erectile problems. And I think that's the reason why many women get badly beaten up or they use objects in women. And he started having problems, and I was also very dry. And I thought, and he started swearing, and I thought, gosh, if he loses his temper, if he feels that I'm judging him in any way, I'm in trouble. So I said, and I was very calm right the way through the rape. And I said to him, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's my fault. It's my fault. I took the blame upon myself. And I think that in some way that soothed him, because after he was finished, he raped or attempted to rape me three times. And after he was finished, he sat me up on the bed and he said, now I'm going to tie you up some more. And he started putting masking tape around my eyes, a very thick masking tape, about 2 inches thick, and then started putting it around my nose. And I said, not my nose, not my nose, because I realized that if it went around my nose, I'd be dead in a few minutes. And he listened to me. And I think the only reason he listened to me was that he'd felt that in some way I was cooperating with him. The really interesting thing about many rapists, not all of them, but many of them, is they have this perverted desire for us to like them, for us to accept them and acknowledge them. And I obviously didn't know that. Maybe instinctively I knew that, but he didn't put it around my nose, put it around my mouth, put more around my hands, around my ankles, around my knees. Then said that he was going to go to the bank and draw money out, but that he'd be back in 15 minutes, that if I did anything, he would come back. When he came back, he would kill me.
How did you decide whether you were going to try to escape in that 15-minute interval or whether you would be the kind of obedient victim and just, like, wait for him, not trying to get out of the bonds that he had tied you with?
I don't know if anyone decides to be an obedient victim, and definitely if you decide to be obedient when you have the opportunity to escape, then you certainly will become a victim, in my belief. I didn't fight at all during the rape, but I was determined to survive, and I'm now very strong about calling myself a rape survivor and other women rape survivors. He, first of all, tried to trick me. He closed the door and he'd put me in a bathroom. He closed the door and I was listening very carefully and I heard that he hadn't locked the door. And I thought, he's not going. And he came back after a few minutes and I hadn't moved at all. And then when he finally went, he locked the door. And then I listened carefully and I heard him go out the front door and lock the front door. And then I even waited some more until I thought I heard him go out the gate. And that's when I started struggling. I realized, I thought, well, I've got 15 minutes and I have to free myself. And it was unbelievably difficult because at first I started panicking and tried to free all parts of me. And then I thought to myself, calm down, focus. You've got to focus. And focused on my hands, couldn't free them at all. And then focused on my feet. and managed to free my feet and my knees. So I was standing up, but I couldn't really see which room I was in. And my hands were still tied up, and I realized I would never be free unless I could free at least one of my hands. And finally managed to do that, although at one stage I can remember leaning against the wall and just thinking, I don't have the strength for this. I'm a small woman, I'm not physically strong, and I thought, I don't have the strength for this. And then a thought flashed into my head that my child would come home and he would see blood everywhere and I would be dead, and that this person might still be in the house and might attack my child. And I thought, I can't let that happen.
You were finally able to undo the tape that he had placed around your body to keep you bound. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you able to scream for help? Did any neighbors respond?
Well, finally, neighbors did respond. Two of my three neighbors closest to me had gone away for the Easter weekend, and the woman next door, at 10 o'clock at night, she decided to go out and get her ironing board and do some ironing, which I think was nothing short of miraculous, because I don't know of many people who do ironing at 10 o'clock at night. And she heard me screaming, and I'd also picked up an object in the bathroom cupboard. I was only able to get one hand free. The other one was still tied up. And I was breaking glass to try and increase the sound and the noise level. And she heard me. And her husband came. She contacted the police. And her husband and another neighbor came. And they found me. They got me out of the bathroom.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlene Smith. She's a South African journalist who was raped a year ago. She reported on her rape and then became an activist in trying to reform the health and legal systems to better help rape victims in South Africa. Charlene, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about some of the changes that are underway in South Africa. This is Fresh Air. My guest is South African journalist Charlene Smith. A year ago, she was raped. She reported on her rape in a newspaper article, then became an activist in trying to reform the health and legal systems to better help rape victims in South Africa. When you were raped, what was the procedure that you went through? Did you call the police first, the hospital first? What was the first thing you did?
Well, fortunately, my neighbors had called the police, and the police arrived. I was a very difficult rape survivor in terms of the police and everyone, quite frankly. When my neighbors let me out of the bathroom, the first thing that I did was I apologized that I wasn't properly dressed. And I also said to them, I said, I've got to get hold of my doctor. I've got to get AZT. I don't want to get AIDS. And we couldn't get hold of my doctor. He'd gone away for the Easter weekend. And one of the young police officers, in fact, a police reservist, a part-time weekend police officer, said he would take me to the district surgeon. And I said, I don't want to go to a district surgeon. I've got to go to a private hospital. Government hospitals won't give me the drugs to stop HIV. I've got to go to a private hospital. And so began a process that was absolutely unbelievably difficult to try and get the drugs to stop me getting HIV. We landed up going to three hospitals that evening. I was treated mostly in an appalling manner, particularly by a woman that evening, until I got the drugs.
Now, what made you think about getting AZT?
For some years, I'd been reporting on the AIDS epidemic in South Africa, and in particular had been reporting on mother-to-child transmission. I think it's a disgrace that we don't give the drugs to stop mother-to-child transmission in this country. We're losing approximately 100,000 babies a year to HIV. And 2 weeks beforehand, I was at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto, where they've got a large program, a trial run by the United Nations looking at mother-to-child transmission. And one of the doctors there said to me, he said, you know, the very last thing that the doctor said to me was, you know, Charlene, we need AZT for women who are raped as well. And I said, gosh, I said, that's interesting. I must do a story about it. at some stage. And that was the last thing that I wrote in my notebook. And 2 weeks later, I was raped.
So you did end up doing a story about it, but you didn't realize it would be your own story.
Yeah.
So were you not given the AZT because of financial reasons or what?
Yeah, I didn't have medical insurance, mm-hmm. And so they wouldn't give me the drugs at the private hospitals. I knew that if I went to a government hospital, because government doesn't give AZT to anyone other than prisoners, I wouldn't get AZT from a government hospital either. So that's why I was going to the private hospitals until finally I had limited medical emergency insurance from a company called Medical Rescue International here. And I finally phoned them and said, look, I've been raped. I need AZT. I need it fast. It's been 5.5 hours since I was raped. I need those drugs and I need them fast. And they said to me, we've never had a call like this before. And I said, darlings, you've got the call now. I need the drug. And it was a young black man who took the call, and I could hear him consulting with other people. And he said, fine, we're going to give you the drugs. They gave it to me for 6 days. This is the hospital you must go to. They'll have the drug there. But even once I went to that hospital, it was a battle. In fact, the hospital that I went to was a private hospital, and they were giving me problems about getting the drugs and et cetera, et cetera. And I said, you know, if by some miracle I'd managed to injure the person who raped me, he would have been wheeled into this hospital past me. He would have received the best medical treatment in the country at the cost of the government, including if he had HIV or AIDS, he would have received the antiretrovirals. And yet I am raped and I can't get that medication. In 1998, government spent 54 million rand treating prisoners in private hospitals, private, not government hospitals, who had HIV or AIDS-related illnesses. However, if you are a woman who's raped or if you are a pregnant woman who has HIV, you cannot get that medication from a state hospital.
Have many women contracted AIDS because they've been raped by men who had it?
Oh, yes, many, many, many. I deal with many of them. There's for women who don't get the antiretrovirals in the society, there's approximately a 40% seroconversion rate, which means that approximately 40% of women who are raped will get HIV afterwards in this country. However, there's an extremely high incidence of HIV in our population. Approximately 1,800 people get infected each day. 36% of pregnant women are HIV positive. Approximately 40% of men aged in the 20 to 29 age bracket, your primary age bracket for people who usually rape, are HIV positive. So we have a very high incidence in our society. But the other thing that makes it very dangerous for you if you're raped in the society is that 75% of rape in South Africa is gang rape. You are more likely to be raped by anything from 3 to 30 perpetrators than by a single individual. Now, if you raped, for example, by 4 people and 2 of them are HIV positive, you're getting a double viral load of the virus. So it's almost as though you're being infected twice, and your risk factor shoots right up. And that's what we're finding. Particularly, there's a myth that if you rape a virgin in this country, you will lose your HIV status. And the children, in my experience, are dying very quickly. On average, it takes a child anything from 8 months to 18 months to die after being infected. Whereas an adult, we've got subtype C in this country, which is the most lethal form of the virus. An adult takes approximately 5 years to die.
How confident are you that taking antiviral drugs will help stop AIDS if you've been raped by somebody who has it?
Since I was raped, a whole lot of research has begun into the relationship between rape, HIV, and antiretrovirals. I was basing some of my belief that it would help me on research done by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta that was done in September 1998 that briefly looked at rape primarily looking at needle stick injuries, but reflected on the fact that in the instance of rape, they believed that there would be a similar success rate if you used antiretrovirals, namely an 81% success rate. The doctors that I'd spoken to at Chris Hani Baragwanath have extensive experience in dealing with mother-to-child transmission. In fact, some of them have co-authored the World Health Organization guidelines on mother-to-child transmission, and they were extrapolating the use of antiretrovirals for rape. And I think it's a disgrace that there hadn't been any research solely and primarily looking at the relationship between rape and HIV beforehand and the use of antiretrovirals. At the moment, there are approximately 5 studies that are going on in South Africa. What they're finding with those studies is for those women who do go onto the antiretrovirals after rape, none so far have seroconverted, or in other words, none so far have become HIV positive. However, you know, nothing is perfect, and I have no doubt that at some stage, some unfortunate woman will probably seroconvert.
How available now are antiretroviral drugs to rape victims, and what's preventing them from becoming more available?
It's still basically only the wealthy or people who have access to medical insurance that can have the antiretrovirals after they're raped. Government is still refusing, despite being offered the lowest prices in the world, to give those drugs to stop the virus spreading in women and children who've been raped. And it's a great shame because last year, as an example, the wife of the deputy president was gang raped. Thugs kicked down the door of her home and gang raped her, and she was immediately put onto the antiretrovirals. A number of daughters and wives of other top politicians in government for the ruling party have been raped, and they immediately put their children, their wives, onto those drugs, but they're refusing to give them to the majority of our people, and I think it's scandalous.
Charlene Smith is a freelance reporter in South Africa. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope by Jonathan Kozel. Real.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And Time. This week in Time magazine, an investigation of pending bankruptcy legislation and how it may affect the public. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about rape and HIV in South Africa with South African journalist Charlene Smith. She was raped a year ago. Then we'll talk about the politics of HIV in South Africa with Philip van Niekerk, editor of the weekly The Daily Mail and Guardian.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with South African journalist Charlene Smith. She was raped a year ago. The article she wrote about the attack helped inspire a movement to reform how the country's legal and healthcare systems treat rape victims. For example, she wants rape victims who may have been infected with HIV to have access to antiretroviral drugs as soon as possible after the attack. South Africa has the fastest growing rate of HIV infection in the world. The reason why you had such trouble getting antiviral drugs was that you didn't have health insurance that would cover them. They're very expensive, and that's part of the reason why they're so hard to get in many countries now. I understand that South Africa recently became the first country to have rape insurance. Tell us about how that works and how that's affecting things like access to antiviral drugs.
I think in approximately June of last year, an insurance company approached me and said that they were aware of the fact that it was very difficult to get the antiretrovirals. They wanted to have an insurance policy around it. I welcomed that and assisted them work on the policy. Initially, they only wanted it to give the antiretrovirals, and I said, you know, we have other things that we can't deal with. After rape, we need to be touched. And so they also gave money for alternative therapies, anything from Reiki to aromatherapy to facials, to encourage people to know that touch is healing and not dangerous thereafter. But that particular insurance policy I walked away from when they refused to give the insurance to women who were prostitutes. And I said I refused to support a policy like that. However, we now have approximately 5 insurance policies in this country. I've helped with all of them. And the one policy that I do support not only gives the money for antiretrovirals as well as alternative therapies, they also give a certain amount of money for security upgrades around a woman's home or a vehicle or her person, depending on what she wants. It also has a package where if you do seroconvert, and this is very important, and if you do become HIV positive, they will put you on an HIV management program. If you get onto one of those programs, if you monitor the HIV, if you change your lifestyle, if you eat properly, you can extend your life expectancy. And I think that's a very, very important clause in that. I don't know how widely used the insurance policies are. The particular one that I support cannot, at this stage, be bought by individuals. It's very cheap. I do believe they are apparently going to be bringing it out of the market sometime soon for individuals. But it's mostly sold to medical insurance companies or to big business who want to protect their workforce.
Now, your rapist was apprehended, tried, convicted, and sentenced to how many years?
30 years. 15 of which were for raping me, and the other 15 of which were for stealing a CD player and 10 CDs from my home.
Now, I understand that the legal system is seldom that effective in apprehending rapists in South Africa.
It's extremely ineffectual, and I think that that's part of the reason why you have such a high incidence of rape in this country, because people who rape know that in very many instances women do not report or don't want to report. And part of the reason why women don't want to report is if and when they do, in most instances they're not treated very well by police officers, or if they're treated well by them on the night that they are raped, subsequent to that, the level of disinterest and apathy and lies and the loss of dockets. In my own instance, within 5 days, they'd managed to lose the entire file with all the evidence collected up to that time. And it was just a continual saga. And my case, I had an article published that I wrote about the rape a week after I was raped. So it very quickly became a high-profile case. But the level of the loss of evidence, of police officers treating me very badly, of the prosecutors treating me badly was quite unbelievable. And here I am, white, middle class. I have access to the doors of power. My situation was a whole lot better than the average woman in this country who is poor, who feels she doesn't have rights anyhow, who's intimidated by the entire system, and she gets an absolute raw deal. She is lucky if the docket is opened at all.
I think one of the changes underway now in South Africa is this. There have been, I think, about 20 special rape courts that have been created. Were you involved in the creation of those courts?
I sat on some of the committees looking at the setting up those courts and some of the needs for those courts. There's a wonderful woman and a team of four women from the Office of the National Directorate of Public Prosecutions, a woman called Tokoma Jikweni, who's heading the establishment of these rape courts. But I wrote in a recent article, these rape courts, a little bit like building a house and putting the windows in first without building a foundation or without building walls. They're closing district examiner's offices in this country, which means the very few forensic examinations that take place in rape at the moment will become almost non-existent. And as all of us know, in very many instances, a rape case stands or falls on the forensic examinations, in particular DNA. And the police investigations are appalling. Now, a prosecutor with the best will in the world can only try a case according to how good the information that has been produced by the investigating team and the medical examiner is. If that is substandard or not up to speed, there's nothing that the best prosecutor in the world can do.
Now, your rapist was black. Are there a lot of racial issues surrounding rape in South Africa? Are white women or black women more frequently victimized? Is rape often considered to be a racially involved kind of crime? You know, is it usually people of... do rapists more often rape someone of the same color or not? You know, like what are the racial issues surrounding rape in South Africa?
I don't think that rape in South Africa is an issue around race at all. I think it's strictly according to demographics. Most people raped are black because most people in this country are black. Most rapists are black because most people in this country are black. There are white people who rape. There are white people who rape white women. There are white people who rape black women. I think that rape is a very peculiar creature. I really have serious problems in saying that it's an issue of race. Maybe in some countries it is. Maybe in a few, very, very few isolated instances, it is about race. But I don't think that an individual who's going to rape necessarily looks at the race group of the person that he's going to rape. He's motivated to rape, and he actually, quite frankly, doesn't care in most instances what her race group is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlene Smith. She's a South African journalist who was raped a year ago. She reported on her rape, then became an activist in trying to reform the healthcare and legal systems to better help rape victims. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlene Smith. She's a South African journalist who was raped about a year ago. She reported on her rape and then became an activist in trying to reform the healthcare and legal systems to better help rape victims in South Africa. Was your rapist tested for HIV? You were so worried about getting it, understandably.
No, unfortunately in this country, the police are using the constitutional right to privacy not to test people who rape, which is exceedingly unfortunate because it means that there's a year in which we could seroconvert and we never know whether or not he is positive or negative or they are positive or negative. So we live with tremendous fear for a year while we continue going for our tests. And I can't understand the interpretation of the law because a rapist, by raping us, has invaded our privacy. He's also threatened our right to life, our constitutional right to life. In South Africa, if you are arrested for suspected drunken driving, the police can, without asking your consent, take a blood sample to test whether or not you are indeed drunk. And yet they won't do it with women who raped. It's quite an extraordinary situation, and it's one that we're campaigning against. We had a 14-year-old child in one of the black townships near Pretoria, as an example, who was raped on New Year's Day in 1998 by three people. They arrested them not long afterwards. They didn't test her and they didn't test them. And when she started getting flu-like symptoms a while later, nobody tested her for HIV. When she developed tuberculosis, nobody tested her for HIV. By April of last year, they'd postponed the case 17 times, and her mother was having to carry her to court on her back because the child was so weak. She died in May of last year. And the three rapists were released because the complainant, who was this child, was dead.
You wrote your newspaper article about your own rape just a few days after it happened. You describe in the article that you were taking, how many drugs was it at that time?
I think it was 28.
Right, and some of the drugs were, antiretroviral drugs. Mm-hmm. Some of the drugs were anti-nausea drugs, plus you took a morning after pill to make sure you wouldn't get pregnant.
Antibiotics to prevent sexually transmitted diseases.
And you even describe in the article how in the middle of writing the piece you had to take a break so you could go to the bathroom and throw up.
Yeah.
How did you find the strength to write that piece so shortly after the rape happened?
On the night that I was raped, I was treated so badly that I said to the young police officer that I've got to turn this around, that I've got to make something good come out of this, that even if I help or save the life or protect just one woman, then I have to do it. And all I knew how to do was to write. So I had to write about my experience. And I wanted to be very clear that I broke the silence, so there's nothing that I won't write about or won't talk about. However, I approached my children and I said to them, this is what I want to do. I want your permission because it'll have an effect on you. There might be some sympathy for the fact that I was raped. However, there will probably be prejudice around the fact that I might be HIV positive, and you have to be ready for that. And I made them go away and think about it, and they both came back to me and they said, Mommy, if you think it'll help even just one person, then do it. And that's what I did. And I have almost overwhelmingly been treated with love and respect by all South Africans. I really didn't think the story would have the impact that it did. And I thought, well, this will just be a 7-day wonder. And here I am a year later, about 70% of what I do is work around rape and HIV. But I think it's important. I think that we have a battle, that we got rid of apartheid. There's no reason why sexual violence should be more difficult.
The last time you were tested, you were HIV negative. Are you convinced that you're in the clear on that?
Well, I have to go for my one-year test. I'm already a month late for my one-year test. I was 6 weeks late for my six-month test. You don't get less anxious about becoming positive. You become more anxious about becoming positive. I think I probably am, yes. My doctor, who's an AIDS specialist, he says that there's about a 1 in 10,000 chance that I'll seroconvert. I think that I've already made up my mind that if by any unfortunate twist of fate that I am positive, then I'll deal with it in a positive way. It's a death sentence, but everything's a death sentence if you choose it to be. That there are ways to live in a good, positive, healthy way that influences other people in a good way.
Why are you 6 weeks late for the test? Is it that you're afraid to face it, or you've been really busy?
I think it's both. I think most of all, I hate these tests. I really, really hate them. And I think that's what everyone underestimates, is that we were convinced we were going to be killed during the rape. And afterwards, we'll do anything to survive. And you're on those antiretrovirals for 28 days, but your first test is only at 6 weeks. And I found that after those 28 days were over, I crashed badly, went into profound, profound depression. until a friend sent up a herbal immune booster, and because I realized my body was on its own and I couldn't protect my body anymore. And I thought, I can remember on that day thinking, I've got such a strong mind, but my body is going to do exactly what it chooses to do, and I can't stop that. And that was terrifying.
The person who raped you broke into your mm-hmm. house. When you tried to resume your life after the rape, did you change your personal security system or change anything about where you went or how you went there? I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, you've been so effective, I think, in trying to reform the South African court and health systems. What about safety and personal protection?
Certainly, initially, I was very, very worried, if not paranoid. And I think a lot of that is post-rape trauma syndrome, where you just fear everyone and everything, mm-hmm. and you're constantly checking doors and windows and that sort of thing. I had an alarm installed in my house. I bought a German Shepherd to protect me, because my other three dogs were very sweet dogs, and I'm afraid that German Shepherds adopted their sweetness, so he'll never protect me. you have to be really careful that you don't become so paranoid that you stop living. One of the things about post-rape trauma syndrome is you don't like going out at night afterwards. There's lots of areas in which you circumscribe yourself, and I think you can continue doing that and fear everyone and everything, and then you will always be a victim. Or you have to make the decision that, okay, this happened to me. It's a terrible thing. It's hopefully the worst thing that will ever happen to me. I'm very, very wounded inside, because we all are. But I have to get up. I have to move on. I have to recreate my life. I have to make it a better life.
Charlene Smith is a journalist in South Africa. Her story about being raped was published in the South African paper The Mail and Guardian last year. She's now working to reform how South Africa's health and legal systems treat rape victims. We contacted both the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the U.S. to find out what their recommendations are on the use of antiretroviral drugs for rape victims who may have been exposed to HIV. They directed us to a 1998 Public Health Service study on possible sexual, injecting drug use, or other non-occupational exposure to HIV. The study concludes that data have not yet been systematically collected in the U.S. Therefore, the Public Health Service is unable to definitively recommend for or against the use of antiretroviral agents for rape victims. The study stresses the need for more research in this area. In Canada, however, the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS has published a report on accidental exposure to HIV, which does recommend antiretroviral agents for rape victims. That report suggests that the antiretroviral therapy be initiated quickly after exposure. Coming up, more on HIV-related controversies in South Africa. This is Fresh Air. One of the reasons it's difficult for rape victims in South Africa to get antiretroviral drugs relates to a current political controversy surrounding AIDS in South Africa, a controversy that is getting a lot of attention because in July, South Africa will be the site of the next International AIDS Conference.
The president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, is worried about how his country is being ravaged by AIDS. He decided to do some reading of his own. He was intrigued by the work of two American biochemists who believe that HIV is not the cause of AIDS. This has led him to be skeptical of antiretroviral drugs as a treatment for people with AIDS. We phoned the editor of the South African paper The Mail and Guardian, Philip van Niekerk, to find out more.
President Mbeki obviously is aware we've got a huge problem, probably the biggest problem that this country and this continent faces, which is large numbers of people are infected with HIV and probably 1 out of 10 of the South African population at the moment, and large numbers of people are dying. So there's obviously a great element of concern. But equally concerning to a lot of people in this country has been President Mbeki's attempts to get involved in debates on the science of AIDS, where what is really required now by a lot of people is that we get ahead with implementing strategies of prevention and dealing with what is the biggest public health disaster in the history of this continent and the history of this country. We are spending a lot of money having futile debates about whether or not HIV leads to AIDS, and particularly the president appears particularly enamored with a group of scientists who are fairly discredited within mainstream science within the world, and believes it's his task or his role to somehow to get a debate going amongst these scientists and to restart this debate. It's not easy to say exactly why he's gone off at this tack, but he has been severely criticized by scientists and by other people in this country, at the very least, for dabbling in science and politicizing the science of AIDS, which is an issue, in a sense, that is best left to scientists, whereas policymaking is really the arena of politicians.
I'm wondering how this AIDS controversy is affecting Thabo Mbeki's popularity in South Africa now.
Well, I think it's the kind of thing which is very much a debate within the elite. I don't think that a lot of ordinary South Africans there are really up to date with the whole issue of the science of AIDS and why it's problematic for AIDS, the science of AIDS, to be politicized in this way. So I don't think that there's actually a response amongst the masses. You know, the broad appeal of Mbeki and the ANC probably remains the same. I think that where he has suffered probably something of a setback is that there are a number of people within the intellectual community who have questioned the way he's gone about it, and in particular the contempt with which he seems to have treated many of those within the scientific community in South Africa. And I think that if anything, if at the end of the day one was to weigh up the damage to him politically, it's in those kind of intellectual circles.
The antiretroviral drugs are not available now at public hospitals. How much of that has to do with the government's skepticism about HIV being the cause of AIDS, and how much of that is just an economic issue, that these drugs are pretty expensive?
I don't think you can really separate out the skepticism from the economic issues, in the sense that you have a skepticism both about the efficacy of the drugs and about the general consensus science of the link between HIV and AIDS. The two things are very much interlinked. If, for instance, you say, well, part of the reason why you can't dispense these drugs is because it's something costs something like 4,000 rand a month. That's almost it's $800 a month for poor people in rural areas, and the question then becomes, well, once these babies are born, if they're born with HIV/AIDS, they are going to be economically a drain on the public health system in a couple of years' time when they start suffering and dying from AIDS-related diseases. So the question of the economics is something that is always sort of argued within a framework or within a context. And if you have an inherent skepticism to the drugs, then it's much easier to make the economic arguments which say that we just can't afford it. On the other hand, if you are convinced of their efficacy and if you are really concerned about saving the lives of those children, then you will find a way to pay for it. We've just spent 30 billion rand on buying new military hardware and naval ships, and a very, very small percentage of that money could have been used to save the lives of children who would otherwise, who are now probably going to die at an early age of HIV/AIDS.
Do you think that Mbeki's statements about AIDS and his skepticism about HIV is serving any larger political purpose for him? Does he have any larger political motivation?
A lot of people are questioning what the motivation is for this. I think that he's genuinely concerned about an enormous problem, and that he's grappling and he's finding ways of coming to terms with it. I think anybody who is in responsible positions of office on this continent right now must be terrified when they start to see the figures that are coming in and the fact that it's spreading and that policy so far has not been able to stop it. There's talk that he spends a lot of time surfing the internet and that a lot of the theories, a lot of the things that he's come up with are from websites that he's encountered and that has been written about and has also been raised as problematic. I don't think that there's anything malicious or that he's doing it out of any kind of need to exploit politically the situation, and I don't think anybody's saying that in South Africa either. As I said, it's an enormous problem, and I suppose that when one tries to come to terms with it, when one tries to address how do you stop it, how do you stop this tide of you know, death and disease, that you might very well start to jump around and try and find extraordinary solutions or try and question the conventional wisdom, because the conventional wisdom so far doesn't seem to be working on the African continent.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Philip van Niekerk is the editor of the South African paper The Mail and Guardian. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Our engineer today was Joyce Lieberman. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From lawyers.com, for researching and understanding the law or identifying a lawyer. Online at lawyers.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's Richard Belzer imagining Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah. Fresh Air turns 13 this week, and we're throwing ourselves a bar mitzvah party with Richard Belzer, Mel Brooks, Richard Lewis, and others. Join us on the next archive edition of Fresh Air.